This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Better late than never. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good morning, universe. Technological difficulties resolved. The hamster back on the wheel. Welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Are we sure we're on air right now?
Well, I mean, it's always a good question for us on a weekly basis, but I think right now I am comfortable in saying we are on air,
like,
in fact.
There's a really good chance, boys, that we're talking right now, and the only three people that can hear us are in this room.
That could very well be the case, but for now, let's assume we are on air, and I will say good morning to you, Mr. Ginsburg. Good morning to you.
It's almost afternoon.
Mr. Mnuchin, it is almost afternoon. Our apologies for the technological difficulties. As we mentioned, sometimes the hamster just falls off the wheel and needs a little bit of time to get back up on it. But we're going to be with you for the next couple hours. It is Toy Mountain, a great cause. We want you to do your part if you're able to. If you can, typically we'd be at CF Polo Park and doing
one of our favorite shows.
One of our favorite shows of the year. But, you know, given that everything else in 2020 has basically been ruined, why can't we this be any different? So, you know, do your part though. Toy Mountain's still going on. We're still trying to raise money and provide gifts for those who are less fortunate, who might not be able to go ahead and do something on their own today. So, you know, check us out. You can get all the information on our website, tsn1290.ca. You know, you can go to the salvationarmy.ca. You can find the link to Toy Mountain. Do your part if you can. Help out. Give us some nice, bright, shiny joy, a little bit of Christmas joy, a little bit of holiday joy in this holiday season.
I believe you can also donate toys at IKEA.
Yeah, IKEA, I believe.
So you can, you know, pick up some Swedish meatballs and donate some toys for some less fortunate ones. So absolutely, especially with everything that's going on right now, we want to make sure that, you know, we get lots of donations in and, you know, lots of toys donated. So, like Dave said, it's usually one of our favorite shows of the year, and you know, make sure you support it.
Yeah, exactly right. So anyways, do your part, Toy Mountain, that's going on right now, and you'll hear from the Toy Mountain studio throughout the next couple of hours, cut-ins from all your favorite TSN 1290 personalities. You know, so what's going to happen this morning is Mitch Melnick is going to join us in a couple minutes' time. You know Mitch, of course, from TSN 690 in Montreal. As it happens, tomorrow, 25 years ago tomorrow, is the famous trade of Patrick Waugh getting traded from the Montreal Canadiens, along with, of course, Winnipegger Mike Keane,
yep,
going to the Colorado Avalanche. Coming back the other way, of course, was Jocelyn Thibault was the, yep, goaltender, the big name in that trade. And it's almost a seminal moment, I would suggest.
Don't forget about Martin Rusinski and Andrei Kovalenko.
Well, I think Habs fans have tried to forget about them as much as possible. But, yeah, it was a seminal moment in hockey in Canada, certainly in La Belle Provence. It was a seminal moment. So we'll talk to Mitch Melnick about that, it having occurred 25 years ago tomorrow, as in earlier this week it was the 25th anniversary of when Patrick Waugh was left in net at the hands of and getting shellacked by the Detroit Red Wings by that 11-1 margin. We all remember him skating off and going to the boards and going over to the president of the Montreal Canadiens and saying this was my last game ever in a Montreal Canadiens uniform. So that famous occurrence, we'll talk about that. Lots of Jets talk as well, of course, through the next 2 hours. We'll get you, you know, there's not a ton of Jets news, admittedly. It's been very quiet and continues to be very quiet, Dave. Mm-hmm. But we got some Jets stuff for you, so we want to hear from you throughout the course of the next 2 hours as well. Send us your tweets at Illegal Curve. You can send us your text messages to 129090, where standard messaging rates do apply as well. So we want to hear from you. Nice to hear from people on Twitter already saying they can hear us loud and clear, and that's great to hear. So we appreciate all of those comments as well. So
we just got a little bit more time to bond with each other, boys, right?
Like, I'm not sure that's good for anybody.
We're sitting around here for an hour and just, you know, talking about yesteryear. It was just a nice little, you know, opportunity to chat. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're just happy that we're on. I couldn't handle it anymore. I'm just used to talking on the show come 9 o'clock. So
yeah, I know.
Thanks to Shawnee and everybody back at the station for fixing that problem.
Exactly, for giving us a hand there with that. Anyways, guys, so you know, it's going to be an interesting Saturday morning here as we're going to bring in Mitch Melnick coming up here momentarily. Hopefully, talk about that Patrick Waugh trade that I mentioned. Let's talk about our memories from that to begin with. You know, what do you remember about that? Because I mean, it wasn't. Well, it's hard to believe it was 25 years
exactly,
ago.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, so that would have made me, I guess I was 13 or 14 years old. You know, if my math is correct, right, 1996, 14. So, I mean, I remember just, You mentioned, Drew, that it was a seminal moment, and it was just, it was the image, the theater of it all, right? Like, just Patrick Waugh, you know, getting pulled after the 9 goals, because many people thought he should have been pulled earlier, like after, you know, 5 goals or 6 goals, well, right? But that Detroit team was so stacked, and what was so funny about it, and, you know, we're gonna have Mitch on in a few minutes, and we have to ask Mitch about, you know, the interview he recently had with Scottie Bowman on his show, because, of course, Patty Roy goes on and he plays for the Colorado Avalanche, and then the Avalanche beat the Red Wings in the playoffs and go on to win the Stanley Cup.
Right.
Right. So it's just funny that, you know, Scottie Bowman is watching that and he's thinking, you know, Patrick Roy is going to go to another team. Little does he know that that team is going to beat his team out on the way to the Stanley Cup. Scottie Bowman also mentions in that interview that, you know, the Montreal Canadiens approached the Detroit Red Wings to see if they were interested in Patrick Waugh, but of course they had just acquired Mike Vernon and had a young Chris Osgood at the time, so mm-hmm. Patrick Waugh didn't quite fit with the Red Wings back then. But, you know, Drew, I remember just, it was the end of an era, because, you know, before, you know, I was an idol, I idolized Marty Brodeur.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, like a lot of kids, I idolized Patrick Waugh. I mean, he was the best goalie in the league at the time. And, you know, we mentioned he goes on to win a couple of Stanley Cups with Colorado in 96 and 2001, but it was just the end of an era. And you knew at that time, especially considering that, you know, Jocelyn Thibault was nowhere near, you know, the level of Patrick Waugh. You knew that the Montreal Canadiens were going to take a step back, you know, from there, and they did. I mean, they weren't a very good team for quite a long time, and that's what happens when you lose your top goalie. So, you know, it was an end of an era in Montreal, and just something that I remember just being so surprised, because you didn't think, like, you just kind of assumed, Dave, that Patrick mm-hmm. Waugh would be with the Habs forever.
Yeah, his name was synonymous with Montreal, right? And I remember the 85-86 Waugh rookie card was such a hot commodity back in the day, and people always were talking about it, how, you know, how coveted it was. The one thing I would say I, you know, really kind of heralded to me was that game specifically, you know, the game when he was in, was the coming of age for the Detroit Red Wings.
Sure.
And what it was, you know, kind of how this was a team that, you know, would come on, win the next, you know, two of the next three Stanley Cups, and such a good hockey team. Like, they really were just unbelievable. And it's interesting, right, that he would go to Colorado, and Detroit and Colorado would end up being such bitter rivals. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting symmetry there. But, yeah, Patrick Waugh, to Eddie's point, he's a guy who I thought would be in Montreal forever. And, you know, when it ended spectacularly.
Yeah. It certainly did end spectacularly. I believe we do have Mitch Melnick now on the line. So let's go to the Hockey Show hotline, and we'll bring in Mitch to talk about that 25 years ago tomorrow.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
From TSN 690 in Montreal, our sister station, we are pleased to welcome to the program Mitch Melnick. Mitch, good morning. Thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
Good morning, guys. What's up?
Not too much. 25 years ago this week. So, you know, I'm sure it's been a hot topic on your program there in Montreal all week long. So it only makes sense that we sort of take that walk down memory lane right now to one of the most seminal moments in, I think, Canadian hockey history, and certainly in Montreal Canadiens hockey history. You know, can you point to that incident, the game against the Red Wings and Patrick Waugh being left out to dry, as almost the end of the Montreal Canadiens dynasty?
Well, it was the end of an era for sure. The dynasty ended in 79 when they won, you know, the last of their four in a row, and then 7 years later, because I think if you go through the history of the Canadiens, I'm not positive about this, but I think they had never gone longer than 7 years without winning a cup, and then bingo, in 86, the seventh year they won a cup, and then they went back to the final, lost to Calgary in 89, and then, you know, from 86 to 93, they won the cup unexpectedly because of Patrick winning those 10 games in overtime. So that was the seventh year, and then it's been Death Valley since, not only for the Canadiens, but for the entire country. So it was definitely the end of an era. It was the worst trade of my lifetime in any sport. And
because of the return or because of the emotional impact?
Because of the return, the obvious lack of return on the day it was announced, and the insanity of it, and it's just worse 25 years later. It's hard to believe 25 years later that that kind of trade was actually made. Not that Patrick was traded. It's the return and the mess that Ron Corey created when he fired Sir Savard as GM and Jacques Demers as coach 4 games into the 95-96 season. They had a pretty good team with a franchise goalie. And everything just slid backwards after that. It was just it was awful. It was just brutal. And you know, as a longtime Expos season ticket holder and a supporter and fan and media type, trading a Cy Young Award winner Pedro Martinez in '97 for Carl Pavano and Tony Armas. I mean, that's the baseball equivalent. So we got hit with a left-right punch there. In the 90s, spaced out by just a couple of years. And I know old-timers in the CFL, and that killed the franchise. That was the last blow for the franchise. And old-time CFL fans will point to the 50s trade of Sam Etcheverry and Hal Patterson to Hamilton. And that resulted in the Alouettes being just brutal and through most of the 1960s. So we've had three of them, but the worst by far is the Patrick trade.
You mentioned Ronald Corey, and he was the Habs president during when the trade was made. And you talk about how he fired Serge Savard earlier in the year, and he fired Jacques Demers earlier in the year. Why did he make those first moves that eventually you could say maybe were the catalyst to the Patrick Roy trade?
Because he was irrational. His ego got in the way. Ron did a lot of great things as the president of the Canadiens. He hired Serge Savard. They were embarrassing as a franchise when he took over in the early 80s. They were given away. The Expos were number one in this city for a brief period in the early 80s. They were actually giving away up to 2,000 tickets a night to fill the forum.
Wow.
I mean, it's hard for people today to understand that. And he took over. He changed everything. He hired Serge, who finished his career where you guys are in Winnipeg, playing for his pal Fergie. And he brought immediate credibility. They built the team. They won 2 Stanley Cups. Ron created the old-timers lounge. There were so many former great members of the Canadiens who were ostracized. They didn't feel welcome at the forum, including and especially the Rocket. And Ron made sure they had a home. Anytime any former member of the Canadiens wanted to visit the forum, they were welcome. They had their own lounge. That was all Ron's doing, and everything was going well. And then, I think there was a lot of pressure leading into eventually the opening of what was then the Molson Center. And he felt that Serge, and he wasn't alone, he felt that Serge was involved in the ownership of the Chateau Champlain Hotel, and he felt that some of his business interests were taking him away from hockey. But Serge had a good staff with him. Before Jacques Lemaire went to New Jersey, Jacques was one of his assistants in between coaching gigs, and he had Andre Boudriat, longtime executives. He had a lot of help. The thing about Serge as the GM of the Canadiens, no matter where the team was at any given point during a season, you always felt that with Serge Savard as the general manager, he was one move away. He was going to fix whatever ailed the team with a move or two, and they'd get back into contention. But for some reason, Ron, felt that he knew more about how to run a hockey team than Serge Savard did, and that just destroyed the team.
Mitch, earlier this week on your show, you had Scotty Bowman on the show, and I listened to that interview. It was a great interview. Anytime I see that Scotty Bowman's going to be on your show, I make sure and listen. And we were talking about it. It was almost poetic that Scotty Bowman happened to be the coach, because, of course, he was the coach of the Montreal Canadiens for all those years, and then Patrick Roy is traded to the Colorado Avalanche, and then he goes on to defeat the Red Wings that year and win the Stanley Cup. I mean, when you think about, the optics of Scotty Bowman, like, could any other coach be behind the bench for that game?
Well, yeah, and it wasn't the fact that it was Scotty is really ironic, but also it was that Scotty told us that was really the coming out party of the Russian Five. I mean, they just toyed with the Canadiens and toyed with Patrick in goal. I mean, that was part of the humiliation. I mean, Patrick is, you guys know what kind of competitor he was. Most goalies are, he didn't want to be shown up, because not only was it a Saturday night on Hockey Night in Canada with Scotty Bowman, it was the Red Wings. The Red Wings at that moment were the best team in the National Hockey League. I think you guys were saying just before I jumped on, it was Detroit was the obvious powerhouse in the NHL, And then the power shifted when Colorado got Patrick in that trade, and they ended up winning the Stanley Cup. So it was, I just remember it, in addition to the moment when Patrick was finally yanked and he approached Corey and said, "I've played my last game here," and sat down and then pouted for the rest of the night. It was the fact that those five guys put on a show like we've never seen that in the NHL. We've had a lot of great players, but five guys on the ice together, it was like the puck was on a thread or a yo-yo. It was just fantastic. I just remember thinking, man, this, I've never seen this, and I was treated, and I was spoiled as a fan to those four cups in a row in the 70s. I saw Béliveau, saw some great hockey, but I didn't see the skill on display, and the lack of pushback from the Canadiens had a lot to do with that. But that was a moment to, so whenever I hear the reference to the Russian Five, I go back to that night because they were all over the ice.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290. Mitch Melnick of TSN 690 in Montreal is our guest, talking about the 25th anniversary of Patrick Waugh being traded from the Habs to the Colorado Avalanche.
Well, Mitch, I'm going to bring it to 2020, the 2020-21 season, because the folks over at The Athletic did a poll of 15 NHL execs, coaches, scouts on the All-Canadian division. And the one team I thought that had kind of the most interesting takes was the Montreal Canadiens, because really you had a couple folks picking them first to finish first. Then you had some folks picking them fifth, second, third, fourth. Like, it was interesting because they were kind of all over the board. So how do you see things playing out for the Montreal Canadiens this season?
I think they're in good shape to compete in the Canadian division, and I think they can hang with Toronto, you know, assuming good health. That's always the disclaimer, right? The guy, like, they finally figured out that Carey Price in his 30s. He's not 22 years old anymore. And so getting Jake Allen, and especially in what figures to be a compressed schedule, there'll be a lot of back-to-backs. And they needed a goal. They haven't had a proper backup for Carey Price since Halak, basically. And he showed once they resumed play in the play-in that he's as good as anybody. He's not a machine. He can't, as big and as strong and as athletic as he is, he needs a breather. So Allen will give him that. Allen seems to be getting better as he approaches his 30s. So they got a really good combination there. I'm most intrigued by Romanov, who hasn't played a single shift in the National Hockey League. But a lot of people are very excited about him. So he'll add some depth to the blue line. I'm most intrigued by up front Jesperi Kotkaniemi, because in addition to Josh Anderson, again, a power forward who can skate, and Toffoli who could finish, Edmondson who has more oomph, a physical presence on, and should help the penalty kill, which was not good last year. Those are impressive moves and addressed glaring needs, but that's based on how they looked in the play-in. And so you're relying on Nick Suzuki and Jesperi Kotkaniemi basically offensively in the 1-2 holes. If that works, then they're an excellent team, because you got Phil Deneau in the more traditional shutdown role, who can also add a little bit of offense and playmaking ability. But the Kotkaniemi that we saw in the play-in compared to the guy who ended his sophomore season was night and day. He put on a lot of weight. He's sturdy. He was running people over, like literally running defensemen over. And he showed off an impressive shot. So Suzuki, I'm not concerned about at all. Suzuki is a brilliant player with incredible vision and hands. So those two guys. So to me, it's Kotkaniemi and Romanov. If Romanov can crack the top six, and it appears he will, and Kotkaniemi can pick up where he left off in the play-in, then they're in really good shape. I mean, honestly, that's a good team with a lot of depth. They're missing a veteran guy on the fourth line. They're missing a Nate Thompson type who's better than Nate Thompson, because right now Deneau is the only guy who can win a faceoff. But I think they'll be as competitive as anybody in the Canadian division.
You know, Mitch, going back to that 95-96 season, Marc-Antoine Gaudin wrote about this in The Athletic, I believe it was 3 days ago, and you know, I'll admit I haven't read the Serge Savard book that was recently released, but in that article by Marc-Antoine Gaudin, he quotes a part of that book where Serge Savard says that, you know, the team revolved around Patrick Waugh too much for the good of everyone. He needed a change of scenery. And then the article goes on to say that, you know, it was quite possible that Patrick Waugh might have been traded earlier in the season. Like, is that something that you think a lot of people outside of Montreal know, that that was almost just the tipping point for Patrick Waugh? And it almost seemed like it was inevitable that he was going to be traded, even if that game and, you know, that those nine goals, you know, hadn't gone in. You know, is that something that you think a lot of people know about, that Patrick Waugh could have easily been traded much earlier in the season?
Yeah, there were definitely trade talks. In fact, I remember doing a show during the 93 run in the first round of the playoffs. They had fallen behind to Quebec 2-0. And we were already speculating, you know, what the Canadiens could get for Patrick Waugh, because if that 93 team wasn't going to make it out of the first round of the playoffs, changes were coming. And then Daniel Bouchard, the goalie coach of the Nordiques, opened up his mouth and said publicly, "We found the flaw in Patrick Waugh's game." And that just re-energized and refocused Patrick. I think they were 16-2 after that, didn't lose a game in overtime, and just brought him to another level and created the legend of 93 with the wink and all of that. But then there were some tough times, and as an outgrowth of what he did, taking that team on his shoulders and doing what nobody will ever do again, there seemed to be a sense that Patrick was, you know, becoming a little too big. He basically ran his own schedule under Jacques Demers. And there was some resentment growing. There was an altercation in between periods with Matthew Schneider. He referred to, it was a source in a Réjean Tremblay column that referred to Matthew Schneider as a cancer in the Canadiens room. And I think we all knew if it wasn't Demers, it was certainly Patrick. It was probably Patrick Waugh as the source. He went through the whole team, and I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way to have that out in public like that. There was, and Serge has said publicly that he was talking seriously to the Nordiques about trading Patrick to Quebec, send him back home for Stefan Fisse and Owen Nolan. So there was a lot of speculation about Patrick being on the block. The problem isn't trading. It is a problem when you're trading a Hall of Fame player. But if you're going to make a trade like that, you got to do better. It's like, you want to fire Serge Savard as a general manager? Okay. You don't hire a guy who couldn't get an interview with any franchise in the NHL as his replacement in Reggie Uhl. It's just that Corey just destroyed the team. And I just remember, guys, the first thing when I got over my shock at what the trade was to Colorado, I knew Rudzinski was a decent player and Kovalenko was built like a tank, and Thibault was a very promising goalie. But I mean, come on, you're trading a guy the height of his career. I remember looking at the playoff totals of Rudzinski and Kovalenko at the time and just shaking my head. I think, okay, did I miss something? Did they have a good playoff run? And their totals in the postseason were minuscule, and it was just, you got the sense that they were going to be haunted for a long time the day the trade was announced. And then, of course, just throw in Mike Keane. Him and Patrick were very tight. Keane had just gone through a bit of a hot time in Montreal when it was misinterpreted what he said. He said, "We don't speak English. We don't speak French." And in the you know, about a unilingual Anglo captain. And remember, this is the height of referendum time in Quebec. And Mike said, they made it sound like he refused to speak French. And he said, I it's not that I won't speak French. I can't speak French. And there was a press conference with Mike Keane and Lyle Odelein and Mark Recchi and Serge Savard and Jacques Demers all showing up. The players had unanimously voted for Mike Keane to be their captain. And Savard publicly supported him. But we knew that the Ron Corey had a habit of moving on from what he deemed to be public relations disasters. And we got the sense that Mike Keane wasn't long for the Canadiens because of that. And at the first opportunity, he got thrown in to the Patrick Waugh deal to Colorado. So it just, everything came tumbling down. It's hard to think about 25 years later how ridiculous it all was, but again, I think as the years go on, it becomes more and more ridiculous. And there's a reason why 25 years later, Réjean Uhl and Mario Tremblay don't want to talk publicly, and neither does Patrick. I mean, Patrick, again, because if Patrick told the truth about what was going on, he'd have to recognize that he was sour. He was sour about the situation. He as great and as brilliant a player as he was, you know, not everybody got along with him, which is normal.
Mitch Melnick is with TSN 690 in Montreal. Mitch, appreciate your time and insight. Thanks so much for joining us down this walk down memory lane 25 years ago this week. Appreciate it, Mitch.
Anytime, guys. Thank you.
Take care, Mitch. Thanks so much. When we come back, we discuss Kevin Cheveldayoff, his ranking among the best NHL general managers. Much more to come. It's also Toy Mountain. We got all that coming for you on this Saturday morning, a very busy Saturday morning. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You know, whether it's free agency or trade, if you have an opportunity to find a player that you know fits you know, with you from a play standpoint, from a personality standpoint, from a just a teammate standpoint, everything, you take that opportunity and jump at it.
That's Jets general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff from a few months ago talking about the quest to acquire new players as part of free agency, as part of trade. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live here on TSN Radio 1290. This segment of the program brought to you by our good friend Dr. Les Rikus and his team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth to ting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. Interesting article, and this is a column, which means it's opinion, it's not fact, of course, coming out of NBC Sports, the NHL Pro Hockey Talk site, from Adam Gretz, who you certainly have heard on this station before. He goes and he ranks the top general managers in the NHL. And he sort of divides them up into categories, you know, the elite general managers, you know, established names with strong track records, definitely above average, and then the middle ground. And the middle ground is where that you would find Winnipeg Jets general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff. And he's actually number 22 overall in his ranking among all NHL general managers. You know, not on the hot seat, because there is a specific category for on the hot seat. But what do you think about that, you know, with Chevy being ranked 22nd among the NHL general managers? And do you think that maybe he is on the hot seat as this 2021 season eventually maybe gets underway in the next, well, hopefully, you know, 6 weeks or so?
Yeah, there's no question that he's on the hot seat. And that's because, you know, the Jets are coming off of a very disappointing season, even though a lot of that was out of Chevy's control, right? Like Buff deciding that he was going to retire and that whole saga. I mean, that wasn't Chevy's fault at all. And there were obviously, you know, some significant injuries that played a part. I mean, we know that, you know, Brian Little's injury, you know, really affected the Jets throughout the whole season and even going into the playoffs, right? Because, you know, the Jets just didn't have a second line center, you know, that was capable, you know, to produce at the level that Paul Stastny did back in 2018. So, I mean, well, first of all, you know how I feel about rankings. And mm-hmm. I realize, you know, Adam Gretz is putting these rankings out, especially right now, because there isn't a lot to talk about. But, yeah, you know, as soon as I go up and down this list, I see David Poile. I think he was right ahead of Chevy at 21. Like, you know, I realize that the Nashville Predators are maybe a team that has taken a step back, and you've even said, Drew, on this show, that they're the most perplexing team to you, not only in the Central Division, but maybe in the entire league in terms of, like, what are the Predators anymore? Like, are they a bubble playoff team? Because they're certainly not a contender anymore. I don't think many people, you know, have the Preds as a contender. But when I look at David Poile's track record, like, I would put him maybe in the top five.
Well, but his track record as of late has been lousy.
No, but I mean, David Poile has been a general manager for over 20 years. Like,
right.
you go back to the, and to me, like, this isn't just like a snapshot of what's going on right now, because even Adam Gretz says that, you know, general managers like, I think he has Kevin Adams and Bill Zito in there. Obviously, they just became general managers.
Yeah, he has them as too soon to tell, so
right.
He's not really ranking those guys.
Well, yeah, and so, I mean, he is factoring that in, but you look at, you know, David Poile in his, you know, couple of decades plus, I mean, he's had that Predators team, and I realize that now some of the moves, you know, haven't quite worked out, but all I'm saying is, you're not basing this on 1 or 2 years. You're basing this on how good they are at managing their team. Now, but, you know, I'm just digressing here. Like, to me, Jarmo Kekalainen is the 19th best GM in the league. Like, to me, Kekalainen is a very smart hockey guy, and you know he has the you know the history, of course, with amateur scouting and everything like that. But all I'm saying is, you know, I take these rankings with a grain of salt, as do you, Drew. But you know, there's always going to be the criticism, and Adam Gretz even mentions that, you know, because Chevy doesn't make a lot of moves. But my argument in support of Chevy would be that when he does make moves, they're usually really good moves. Like you look at the Evander Kane trade. Jets won that trade. I'm not even going to listen to anybody that says otherwise. You look at the Paul Stastny trade to bring him over, you know, in 2018. Well, that was pretty good. The Jets went to the Western Conference Final, almost went to the Stanley Cup Final, right? You know, acquiring Dylan DeMello. I mean, Dylan DeMello instantly made the Jets' defense better, and Chevy didn't have to get a lot to acquire
him. Even the Jacob Trouba trade.
Well, and again, yeah, Neil Pionk and a first-rounder that turns into Ville Heinola for Jacob Trouba. And, you know, there, you know, his back was up against the wall. He needed to trade Jacob Trouba. At the time, people were saying, like, who's Neil Pionk? Well, Neil Pionk has turned out to be a top-four defenseman for the Jets. So all I'm saying is, even if Chevy doesn't make a lot of trades, usually, you know, the one or two trades he makes a year are ones that he wins.
I would say the Trouba one is probably the most significant because he had the least leverage. You know, I mean, it's one thing when you have the ability to make a trade and it's not talked about, but everybody, every other general manager knew that, you know, his back was up, it was against the wall with Jacob Trouba because Trouba wanted out. So, you know, that doesn't give Kevin Cheveldayoff a tremendous amount of leverage. And at the time, remember, he got rocked pretty hard because people were like, Pionk's numbers in New York were terrible, even though New York was a terrible team. And obviously at the time, you didn't know what you were getting for the first round pick. Got Ville Heinola. Neil Pionk turned out to be a nice player. So it's one of those things. That's why it's very hard to judge these things instantly. And we live in an instant gratification society. People need to make instant conclusions about things. But yeah, that's why you sometimes want to see these things play out. So, you know, like I said, the trades he's had to make, he's done fairly well.
I'll say this much, Drew, just quickly here, because I know we got Mark Masters coming up after the break. Like, Joe Sakic, Steve Yzerman, 1 and 2, like, I have no problems with that. I mean, you look at, you know, like what Steve Yzerman, what he did with Tampa Bay, and, you know, I like some of the sneaky moves he's made with Detroit. Obviously, you know, the Red Wings most likely won't be a playoff team, but, you know, Joe Sakic has that Colorado Avalanche team looking like they're going to be a Stanley Cup contender for the next 5 years. So I have no problem who's at the top of that list, but, you know, in terms of, you know, is Chevy, you know, in the top 20, in the top 15, I would probably have him a little bit higher than that. Like, he has Don Waddell, I think, like 12th or 13th. Like, to me, Don Waddell, that's a little bit high, but again, I mean, that's why it's subjective and you shouldn't take this that seriously.
When we come back, Mark Masters of TSN joins us to talk about the upcoming World Junior Hockey Championships. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Dave Manuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you. You can reach us here via Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us also via a text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. Trying to get a hold of Mark Masters. We'll bring him on as soon as we're able to do so. We were talking before about Kevin Cheveldayoff and his standing as part of you know, the general manager rankings, if you will. A subjective evaluation, if there ever was one. Comment coming in via Twitter from Ronnie DeWally saying, Chevy is the most overrated GM in the entire league. So that's some strong comments coming in via Twitter already. Want to hear from you. Send us your comments, and we will contribute to the conversation.
That article, though, that we just talked about is completely the opposite of that, though. If anything, he's underrated because he was ranked 22nd.
Well, no, I think Ronnie's saying, talking separate from the article. I think he's saying that in Ronnie's opinion.
But that's what we were talking about. Yeah. But, I mean,
look, it's an important year for Kevin Cheveldayoff.
Absolutely is.
You know, to your point about, you know, should he be on the hot seat? You know, I think there's a ton of pressure on Kevin Cheveldayoff, and there should be a ton of pressure as well on Paul Maurice, even though he did sign that contract extension relatively recently. The Jets team, as we've discussed for really all offseason now, for going on, can't even keep track of the months, 3, 4, 5 months, this Jets team is plateauing. And fans in Winnipeg, you know, the paying customer, will demand or should demand, you know, better than a plateau. They should see what is the game plan for this team, what is the game plan for this franchise for, you know, the next 3 years, the next 5 years, you know, because status quo probably isn't good enough. Now, there probably is some, you know, who would say this year is going to be such an aberration because of COVID that maybe every general manager and every head coach should get a bit of a pass for this coming season. I don't fall into that camp. I mean, at its core, it still comes down to wins and losses and the roster that you field or you put on the ice night in and night out. So right now, you know, when this season starts and at the end of the season, if the biggest weakness for the Winnipeg Jets continues to be left side defense, if there's still that massive hole and that doesn't get resolved over the course of the next, you know, 50 or 60 games, fans at the end of the season are going to say, well, what did you expect? We knew back in, you know, August and September and October and November and December before the season started that your left side defense was not going to be good enough. And lo and behold, it hasn't been. So, you know, when that continues, fans are rightfully going to say, why did you put forward a substandard lineup if that doesn't resolve itself with the internal improvements from guys like Samberg or Heinola and things of that nature? I believe we have Mark Masters now, so let's go to the Hockey Show Hotline.
Now, let's go live on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TSN, he's going to cover the World Junior Hockey Championships. A good friend of ours, Mark Masters, joins us. Mark, are you quarantining in a Red Deer hotel and you haven't seen the light of the day for the last 2 weeks?
Actually, I was about to fly to Red Deer, or I guess Calgary, and then drive up to Red Deer about a day before they announced the camp was suspended. So I got lucky because that would have been a long way to go to either sit in my hotel room or turn around. So I'm at home. My travel keeps getting pushed back because they're really clamping down for the next week because they come out of quarantine this coming week, and they just really want to be as safe as possible and get the heck into the bubble with everyone. And that's the big challenge. So I'm going to cover again. I've been covering it this week. Well, covering in air quotes a quarantine. Like shooting fish in a barrel. All the players have nothing to do, so they're happy to do interviews. But to be honest, this is a reporter's dream in terms of, I mean, there's nothing happening. I mean, I'm reporting on rock, paper, scissors tournaments on Zoom. But yeah, I'll be covering some actual practices next week via virtual Zooms, which will be a challenge, but I think it's for the best.
Are we, you know, and we'll get to the team and we'll get to the roster composition momentarily, but are we maybe paying not enough attention to how absurd it is that there's this, you know, large number of teenagers being trapped in a hotel room and in a hotel for weeks on end? Shouldn't that be almost more of a story just about how absurd this entire scenario is?
Well, a lot of them are used to it, or actually getting more frustrated, because I was talking to Dawson Mercer and he said that by the end of this week, he will have 8 weeks in quarantine since the pandemic started. He had to quarantine when he went home to Newfoundland. He had to quarantine when he went back to Chicoutimi. He had in the QMJHL. He had a quarantine after there was a positive test in Chicoutimi on a staff member, and right before he came to Canada's camp. And then he has to do this quarantine. And then I know, you know, a bunch of them have already been through something similar, but 8 weeks of quarantine in however long of, what is it, 8-9 months now that we've been through this. It is bizarre, and they're trying to get better, right? They're doing Zooms. They had Morgan Riley of the Leafs, Alex Kerfoot of the Leafs as well, and Sam Reinhardt of the Sabres, all Hockey Canada alums come in and give a virtual talk. They had Stephanie Labbé and Kadisha Buchanan of the women's soccer team. Max Kerman, the Arkells frontman, did a Zoom and played some songs. So they're doing their best to try and make this go, you know, as smoothly as possible and try and, like, grow as a group and do some bonding. One of the issues is they still got 46 players in camp, and I'm sure as soon as they get out, there's going to be pressure to release a lot of them because they have to really narrow things down, get down to one group and focus on the final battles because they go into the bubble on the 13th. So, it is theater of the absurd, and that's just the way we are. It's just the way we are right now in terms of society in general, and certainly, for sports.
You know, earlier this week, Mark, it was announced that by Hockey Canada and the Rangers that Alexis Lafreniere, of course, the first overall pick of the 2020 draft, he wasn't going to be joining Team Canada. And based on what you were just talking about, I'm sure that Alexis didn't want to be quarantining in a Red Deer hotel. But, you know, all joking aside, did that not really come as a surprise to you? Because I guess Hockey Canada knew all along that there was a good chance that, you know, the Rangers wouldn't be releasing Alexis Lafreniere for the selection camp.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a shock to anyone. You leave the door open because it's Alexis Lafreniere, and he's the first overall pick, and he was the MVP of the World Juniors last year, and you're going to do anything you can to make it to so that he can be in this tournament. But I understand it from the Rangers' point of view. They want their first overall pick to be ready for day one of NHL training camp. They don't want him injured. He could get injured in training. It's happened. But, you know, he was injured in the World Juniors last year. As we know, he sustained a knee injury, missed a couple of games before returning, which made the fact he won the MVP even more remarkable. That's how good he was. And frankly, he's better than that level. He's proven that. I still think it would have been useful in terms of playing intense games. But you're weighing the pros and the cons, and I think the Rangers, you know, they weighed it, and I'm sure that Lafreniere is thinking in this age of the pandemic. I haven't talked to him, but you know, it's I guess a lot easier to be in one spot, right? You know, just safer that way. And he seems to have a good setup in New York where he's training with some of the guys, and I get the decision.
You know, Mark, one thing we always look at is what jerseys are going to look like. And that's, you know, you don't see a lot of equipment modifications generally in these types of tournaments. But one thing that got leaked yesterday, I think it was yesterday or the day before, were these customized skates that the players were all going to be wearing with their countries on them. Has there been any buzz from the players, any reaction? Because to me, like when I was looking, I saw the folks at Bar Down put out a series of tweets as to what they're going to look like. They look slick. Has there been any reaction from the players?
Well, I haven't heard any reaction. I do know that some players last year had those Bauer flag kind of skates. I know I remember talking to Ty Dellandrea, and he was really pumped. He's like a collector. And so they had the option, the Bauer guys, of wearing them last year. And now it looks like Bauer has just expanded it, and every country is going to have that opportunity to use those kind of patriotic skates. So I haven't heard much. I know they're pumped, though. I mean, it's just, let's be honest, there's going to be no fans. There's going to be no friends or family in the bubble. It's going to be a challenge, and you're going to want these little things to just, you look down at your feet and you remember, you know, what this is all about. In a way, it sounds corny, it sounds hokey, but I'm sure it's fun for the guys, and they're all gearheads to begin with, so this is just another thing to fixate on, and it's good on Bauer for doing that. And I love anything that allows the guys to show a little bit more personality, and this might be one of those things, personalized skates.
Mark Masters is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. Reminder that Toy Mountain is going on today. For more information, go to toymountain.ca or text TOY to 129090, and we'll send you all the details.
Jets, Mark, we have to ask you about Jets draft pick Cole Perfetti. I think we're actually contractually obligated to ask you about Perfetti, but with all the great centers that are expected to play for Team Canada, right? So we're talking, you know, Kirby Doc, we're talking, you know, Dylan Cousins, we're talking Quinton Byfield. You know, when you're talking about Cole Perfetti, is it almost just a given that he's going to be playing on the wing?
I would think so. I would think so. He, you know, you look at the depth they obviously have down the middle of the ice with Cousins and Byfield, obviously, as returning guys, and now Kirby Doc coming out of the NHL. I suppose there's that fourth line center spot open, so theoretically it could be in that spot. But it's a deep team. I mean, other than Lafreniere, they got everybody, which is rare for Team Canada, as we know. And I thought Cole, you know, first of all, had a pleasure of doing a trivia challenge with him earlier this week. He's the CHL Scholastic Player of the Year, and so no surprise he won 3-2 over Thomas Harley, the OHL Scholastic Player of the Year a year ago. So he's got a great personality, as you guys probably have already picked up on. So it's been fun to talk to him. I thought his first week on the ice was up and down. And I think, you know, that's to be expected when guys are just kind of coming together for the first time in months. And it's been a busy time for him with the draft and whatnot. So I would suspect he's probably going to be on the wing, assuming he's on the team, but you also have to be ready to move to the center if there's injuries or whatever. You might get flipped there for a shift or whatever, and they know he has that capability.
Mark, last question for you. Obviously, you know, Team Canada goes into this tournament, you know, as the almost the favorite year after year. But who do you think is their biggest competition this coming edition of the World Junior Hockey Championships? And, you know, an addendum to that one, reports out of Sweden today that William Eklund will be unable to participate due to COVID-19. How significant of a loss is that for Team Sweden?
It's a significant loss, and that's the other thing that we've passed the date. It was November 29th. If you tested positive after that date, you're out of the tournament. So that's why Hockey Canada is being so careful in their camp right now. They know one more, if any of these guys test positive, they'll be ruled out. So that's a big loss. When you look at Team Canada's path to a gold medal, I think they've benefited by the way the pools have broken down, because I think you're going to want to ease into this tournament. Because especially the Canadian players, most of them haven't played competitive games since March. Some of them have played in the QMJHL, but not a lot of games, and not in a while now because this camp is so long. And certainly the same for the three NCAA guys who are in camp as well. They haven't played in a while, although Dylan Holloway got a couple of games. So Canada gets to ease in with games against Germany, Slovakia, Switzerland, and then they get to Finland on New Year's Eve. So Finland will be that big game. That will be the big challenge in the group. And then you want to win that because the other group is so stacked. And the Americans have 10 returning players. Cole Caulfield's off to a good start down south of the border. They have Spencer Knight in net. And if Spencer Knight struggles, they have Dustin Wolf, this top CHL goalie out of Everett, who's on standby. Russia's got Yaroslav Askarov, a top pick in the recent draft. So the U.S. and the Russians have their number one goalies locked and loaded, which could be an advantage. Sweden's always strong in net. I mean, those are the countries that you're looking at. Russia has a new coach this year in Igor Larionov, an assistant last year taking over from Valeri Bragin, who had 8 years behind the bench as the head man. So it will be interesting. That will be an intriguing storyline to see how Russia gets handled at the World Juniors with Larionov behind the bench. So that's kind of the lay of the land. You know, there's obviously an idea that there's going to be things unexpected that happen. There's always unexpected things at the World Juniors because these are teenagers making mistakes. But now, given the layoff, there's an even greater sense of uncertainty about this. But you would think, because of the depth of talent Canada has, they would be the favorite to win this tournament.
Mark Masters is with TSN. He covers and is eventually going to be in Alberta for the upcoming World Junior Hockey Championships. Mark, appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. You guys stay safe.
Take care, yeah, Mark. Likewise, too, Mark. Back to you. Mark's appearance on the show was brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. When we come back, we discuss Neil Pionk. He's an RFA at season's end. What might his next contract look like? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Pionk takes it to the middle of the ice, down for Lining. Back for Pionk. Over for Wheeler. Wheeler plays it back. One-timer score! Neil Pionk with the shot.
Our buddy Dennis Bayak with the call. Neil Pionk with the blast from the point, scoring on that clip. Pionk, very good season last year for the Winnipeg Jets. Made a lot of people forget very quickly about Jacob Trouba. 6 goals, 39 assists, 45 points. A lot of that coming on the power play. You know, it's interesting, you know, that we talked about the power play last week, and it was only 15th, I think, in the NHL. Get that power play back up to, you know, top five. You know, top 10, Neil Pionk's numbers are even going to increase upon that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Pionk is a guy that you expect to have, you know, in an 82-game season, you expect him to be around, you know, 45 to 50 points, and he should be consistently. And of course, I mean, a lot of those points come from the power play, but, you know, that shows you his skill level. If Paul Maurice and the coaching staff are confident to put him out there on the first power play unit, and, you know, I think, you know, that argument is out there that, you know, maybe Neil Pionk is better suited to be on the second power play unit because he doesn't have, you know, as good of a shot, especially, you know, when you're talking about guys like, you know, Dustin Byfuglien or Jacob Trouba, who used to patrol the blue line in that spot on the Jets power play, right? But, you know, I absolutely agree. When Jacob Trouba was traded and the return was Neil Pionk, I don't think many people here in Winnipeg really, or elsewhere, you know, around the hockey world really knew about Pionk, but he was a very nice, pleasant surprise, you know, for the Jets. And, you know, that's why it's going to be very interesting to see what the next contract is going to be for Pionk, because I don't think you expect, you know, like a 6 or 7 year deal.
Why don't you? This is a guy who's coming. He's going to be an RFA at season's end. He's going to be, I believe, if I'm not mistaken off the top of my head, I think 3 years away from unrestricted free agency.
Yep.
So, you know, he signed that 2 year bridge deal here in Winnipeg.
Yep.
Getting paid $3 million a season. He's putting up, you know, he would have been over 50 points mm-hmm. had there been a full season last year. You know, if you're Kevin Cheveldayoff, David,
yep.
are you making a long-term commitment to Neil Pionk? Are you making that 6, 5, 6, 7 year commitment to Neil Pionk based on what you've seen so far? Remember, and let me just add an addendum there. He is eligible at any point now
mm-hmm.
to sign a contract extension with the Winnipeg Jets. And the Jets, historically, at the start of training camp, have loved to extend one of their players to a long-term deal.
Sorry, this just came in. Neil Pionk has signed a contract for... Just kidding.
Very funny there. It's very humorous there, Mr. Ginsburg. But, you know, Dave, what are you doing in this case? Are you willing to commit to him? Have you seen enough to make that long-term commitment to Neil Pionk? And he's probably going to demand, you know, $5.5 or $6 million a year based on his numbers.
No, that's too high.
Well, that's the numbers. You put up 50 points in the NHL as a defenseman in a top four role. That's what it's going to cost you over the course of a contract.
Ryan Pulock just signed for $5 million a year. I mean, he's not Ryan Pulock. Like, I'm sorry, like, Neil Pionk is a really good defenseman, Drew, but he's only played 2 full seasons in the NHL.
Well, and that's the key.
I don't think he's necessary. Like, I mean, Josh Morrissey's making $6 million a year, right? Like,
right.
I think Neil Pionk, like, I was looking at some comparables, and I know, Drew, in the show plan, you put out a couple comparables, and, like, I look at a guy like Will Butcher on New Jersey, a guy that played, you know, 4 years of college. If you remember, he was drafted by Colorado, and he's played now, I believe this is his 4th full NHL season. Like, we're heading into his 4th full NHL season. Will Butcher makes just under $4 million. Like, I think he's at 3.7.
Yeah, but he doesn't put up anywhere near the numbers that Neil Pionk puts up.
No, but Will Butcher had 42 points in his rookie year.
Fine.
But, and so his numbers have gone down, but the Devils are a bad team. I'm just saying, like, his number, yes, I realize his numbers were down this year. He was just over 20, but Will Butcher is going to be a consistent, like, 30 to 40 point defenseman. So I think you're looking at, you know, somewhere between that and what I was saying is Ryan Pulock. Like, I think for me, Neil Pionk is a guy that's probably going to be around 4 to 4.5 million. Like, yeah. I would imagine that he's probably going to sign a 4 year deal or a 5 year deal. And who knows, Drew, maybe he does get, you know, that extra year and maybe it's a 6 year deal or a 7 year deal. But you'd have to think that, you know, Dylan Samberg and Ville Heinola are going to be guys that once they come out of their entry level deal, those guys are going to sign long term contracts.
Right.
So I think you have to factor that in. Like, I'm not saying, like, I really like Neil Pionk. That's not what I'm saying. All I'm saying is, like, I don't necessarily know if you're going to, you know, hit a home run here and get a 6 or a 7 year deal, considering that you're going to have 3 other defensemen under long term deals. That's all I'm saying. But so that's why I would guess it would be like 4 years, 5 years.
And one thing you have to always factor in is what is coming down the pipeline. What is going to potentially come to take that spot? Are you stifling someone's growth by giving that spot to Pionk?
And I would say you're not, because on the right side of the Jets defense
most of the young guys in the system are really on the left side defense.
Right.
You know, it's probably a safe bet, you know, to have DeMello, Pionk, and Pullman. I mean, obviously Pullman's going to need a new deal as well as your right side. Because, I mean, that just seems to be the reality for the Winnipeg Jets for the next little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, but I think you have to be a little cautious. Just as folks in New York were celebrating when Neil Pionk got dealt and folks in Winnipeg were crying about it, and then Neil Pionk had a very good season, you know, for his first year, you kind of have to want to take a test. You want to measure it, I would think, before you're willing to gamble on that sort of really long term. Because to Desi's point, you have other guys who are going to be for sure staples of this lineup for years to come.
Well, and that's why Drew does make a good point, though. I mean, the Jets are much stronger in the future on the left side. Maybe not now, but I agree with you. When you project, you know, Josh Morrissey, Ville Heinola, Dylan Samberg on the left side,
mm-hmm.
that could be your left side for 10 to 12 years, right?
Like, if everybody plays out the way that
you anticipate. You got Declan Chisholm.
Right,
you got,
absolutely.
You know, Devonte, you got
Chevy,
a lot of young
Chevy, for sure, you know, in 2022-23, you know, that's who he's got on the left side. And on the right side, you've got DeMello, and, you know, you're going to have Pionk, we think, under contract. But That's all I'm saying, because the 6 or 7 year deals, I mean, those are the contracts that you give to your best players. And Neil Pionk is a good player, but I'm not going to put him in, you know, the category of, you know, the Jets' best players.
Time will tell. It's just an interesting food for thought. A guy coming off of a sort of an unknown quantity who had a very good year for the Winnipeg Jets, offensively at least. The rest of the team, we know about the struggles on the defensive side of the game. When we come back, we're going to talk to Al Strachan, and he's got a new book out on the market. It's called Hockey's Hot Stove, The Untold Stories of the Original Insiders, all about the satellite hot stove. That's up next. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg with you, Dave Minuk here as well. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us here via text message. Send your text to 1290. Standard messaging rates do apply. And of course, our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio, that's available at IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the program Al Strachan. And you know Al, of course, from his legacy as a tremendous hockey journalist. He's in the media section of the Hockey Hall of Fame, and he has a new book out on the market. It's called Hockey's Hot Stove, The Untold Stories of the Original Insiders. Al, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. I haven't talked to you guys for a while. I guess once you retire, you don't bother with people anymore, right?
We always have time for you, Al. You know that. You can just give us a call. We'll always make time for you. You got to keep putting out books. I got to say, Al, I had a lot of fun reading this book.
No, good. Yeah, well, it's mutual. I've got time for you guys, too. We've done it many times over the years.
I appreciate that, Al. I got to go back. I mean, it's, you know, at any point in time, when you were sort of this appointment viewing for hockey fans throughout Canada, you know, did you really get a full appreciation for how important and how, I'm going to say, almost unprecedented it was that what you were doing and what, you know, John Davidson was doing and what Eric DeHatchick was doing, and of course Ron McLean is the host of the segment. Did you get a full appreciation for how seminal it really was in the hockey community?
I'm not sure if we did or not, but we came pretty close, and we had a feeling that we were the voice of hockey and we were transmitting it to the hockey fans. We felt that hockey is indeed Canada's game, and John Shannon, who was the producer of it all, helped us to feel that. And we felt that, as he did, that we were bridging the gap between the players and the executive side of the game and the fans, and we always tried to make it as if it were a barroom conversation or whatever, that we were chatting and that the viewers could feel that they were sitting in as well. And we talked over each other, as you do when you're sitting around a bar, and we just went from one topic to another. We leapfrogged. We had no script, of course. We just had a general idea of what we thought we might talk about, but McLean usually went somewhere else, and we didn't do that. And we just perhaps were reminded of a story when somebody else said something, and so we would jump in. But I think you're right that it was really an integral part of the game at the time, that everybody did watch it, and so many people counted upon it for being the source of information, and not everybody believed everything that they saw, but they certainly were given groundwork to discuss when they went back to work on Monday or when they were out with friends themselves on the following days. So in a way we did, but it's only, I think, later on in writing this book maybe that I came to a full appreciation of it, but we were pretty close back then.
Al, I'm currently reading the book. I'm not quite finished, and you know, as Drew mentioned, it's an awesome read, and I made sure that I wrote down in my phone in the notes that one line that you wrote because I loved it, and I was like, I knew you were coming on, so I had to ask you about this, and I forget what chapter exactly it was, but you wrote that my style was to be abrasive and prod the hockey establishment into working harder to overcome the weaknesses. I just love that line because I almost think that it really encapsulates you, you know, perfectly, and what I want wanted to ask you was, do you think there are enough hockey journalists these days that are abrasive and prod the hockey establishment?
It's hard to do because I think some of them who are trying to do the prodding are really hockey haters, and they want to destroy the game, essentially. They think it should be changed for one reason or another because it doesn't fit with their idea of what should happen in today's society, and I never wanted that. I just wanted to prod them a bit to improve it, and I always felt that way. And if you go back to my earlier columns in the Montreal Gazette, I was always one of the people, perhaps the only one, who was plugging for higher glass all the time because pucks were being just shot out at random, and then the higher glass came in and kept the puck in play, which, of course, is what fans want to see. They don't want to see face-offs because the puck went in the stands. And I was also pressing at that time for something that Burke is taking credit for lately, which is a larger ice surface and not a European size, full size, but a bit bigger. And they were building new stadiums all around the league at the time, and I kept telling Ziegler, who didn't listen to me an awful lot, that they should build the surfaces a little bit bigger. And they came up with this stupid idea of taking away the bottom two rows, which pay more. Well, you don't take away the bottom two rows. You do take away, but you still, that just means that you're still going to have 15 high-priced rows. They're just not going to be in the same place. You're not stuck with 13 if you build a larger ice surface. And there was no reason. He said that, well, we shouldn't have this because they needed consistency. Why? Why? There was no consistency anyway. Buffalo and Boston had smaller ice surfaces. Chicago had a bigger one. And in baseball, they managed to do quite well with baseball stadiums that aren't all the same size. So, you know, I've always, I think, throughout my career, tried to prod them, but not in an attempt to destroy the game, as some people seem to want to do these days, and they want to bring in lawyers to make the game more difficult and make the operation of the game more difficult.
Al Strachan is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. A reminder, Toy Mountain is going on today as well. For more information, visit toymountain.ca or text TOY to 129090. We'll send you all the details. Al's new book is called Hockey's Hot Stove, The Untold Stories of the Original Insiders. Al, throughout the book, you have, you know, many references to Ron McLean. And, you know, you mentioned him in your original answer as he would, you guys would say, okay, you know, Al, Ron, we want to talk about item X to begin, and he would inevitably start with item Y. You know, why did he do that? And do you think that, maybe I'm misinterpreting the book, but did Ron McLean maybe have some, maybe not appreciate the hot stove as much as you think he should have?
I thought he didn't. He liked to run the entire operation, and he was able to do that in a way once Shannon got pushed out. And for a while there, before other people came in that really knew what they were doing, before they gave Najak a position of authority, Ron used to pretty well decide what was going to happen with regard to the show and who was going to do what. I mean, obviously you had the game, but the things that around it and before it and after it and everything, Ron had a lot to do with that, yeah. And he just at times wanted to make the hot stove his. He didn't like it, I don't think, because he couldn't control it. And he liked to control pretty well everything else was there. And so he would at times try and make it difficult for him. It was quite common, as I mentioned in the book and I've mentioned before, he would say, John, JD, you start with A, and then Huey, you follow with B, and Al, you go to C. And then as soon as we went on the air and the producer would point at McLean, he'd say, Al, what about D? And I think in one of the ones that's available on Facebook or whatever, I say, what, you're starting with me? You know, because that was never the plan. And Eric mentioned that too, I think, in some of the things that he's saying in the book, that you work very hard during the week to get something that you think is a really good piece for Hot Stove, and you tell Ron, hey, this is really good. And he doesn't bring it up until there's 15 seconds left. And he would do that consistently, I think, partly because it was the one segment of the entire operation that he wasn't directing or running.
Did you guys ever resent him for that? I mean, you're, to your point, you work so hard all week, you're cultivating your sources, you have a story that hasn't been reported, anywhere else, and that's why people are tuning into the hot stove, and you're being sabotaged, my words, not yours, by the host. I mean, I try and sabotage Ezzy and Dave here all the time, but that's just because we're friends. I would be furious. I'd be chewing glass if I was you or JD and you mentioned Jim Houston and Eric and, all the litany of cast of characters that came through the hot stove.
It never got that bad. No, partly because we were all, I think, a very strong team at Hockey Night. There was never any serious resentment among the people who were there all the time. Once in a while, they would bring somebody in that we didn't like, but the people who were the regulars, no, we just accepted it as being the way McLean was, and we would laugh about it more than anything. And the thing was that McLean couldn't control our time. We were going to be on there for our 8.5 minutes, and he couldn't stop that. So we were able to get a lot of stuff out, even if it wasn't the stuff that we would have preferred to have seen. And, I would say to Ron, what about, we didn't get to it, guys. I said, so no, there was never any really serious resentment. It was just a talking point over beers later on.
Al Strachan is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the author of a new book. It's called Hockey's Hot Stove, The Untold Stories of the Original Insiders. It's available everywhere at all fine booksellers now.
Al, there's a chapter later in the book where you, of course, talk about the trade of Wayne Gretzky from the LA Kings to the St. Louis Blues, and Winnipeg is actually in that chapter because, correct me if I'm wrong, Gretzky's last game with the Kings was against the Jets.
Absolutely.
In the Winnipeg arena, and you flew to Winnipeg to talk to Wayne Gretzky about the trade, and he kind of just wanted to go over it with you, and then, of course, you fly to Vancouver. St. Louis plays Vancouver. The rest is history. But, you famously, broke that trade a couple of months earlier, and you write about that in the book. You broke that trade that was upcoming for the Toronto Sun, and then you talked about it a week before the trade actually happened. What was that like for you to cover that? Because that was the biggest story in the hockey world at the time, and as a second part to that question, I wanted to ask you, did you have any idea, that Wayne Gretzky would only be playing, less than 20 regular season games for the Blues? Because, of course, the Blues got knocked out of the playoffs, and then, he was on his way to the Big Apple shortly after.
No, what the knowing about that trade did was make me even more arrogant, if you think that's possible. I always thought of myself really as being, one of the best hockey columnists, and later on in life after that, I sort of wore down a bit, and people like Eric Dahatchik and that took over from me because, you get older and you don't work as hard. But at that time, I used to think that I was right up there in the forefront, so it was just expected, really, to have those kind of stories and to be a close friend of the greatest player in the game and to know what he was thinking and doing and that. But as for him going to St. Louis, it was never the intention of him to stay there only that long. Keenan was the general manager, and he was building a team there, and he had brought in some of the Oilers who had won a number of Stanley Cups, and he foresaw building the same kind of team in St. Louis. And if you remember, they had a fairly good run that year until Nick Kiprios intentionally flattened Grant Fuhr in Toronto in the first round, and then they had to play with the backup goalie, what was his name, a little skinny guy, I forgot his name, no, John Casey, that's who it was, John Casey, who really did an excellent job, but he was no Grant Fuhr, and then they lost Game 7 in double overtime in Detroit that ended their Stanley Cup run, and Keenan intended to keep that team together and had been promised by the people in St. Louis that they would. But then when the summertime came and the budget came and things like that, they changed their mind, and most of them went on, including a number of them went to New York. I think McTavish went to New York as well, didn't he? And
he did.
And did Charlie Huddy go to New York? Anyway, a number of them, led by Wayne, went to the Rangers, but that was never the intention, no. So, no, I did not expect that.
Al, last question for you. Throughout the book, you talk about the influence of John Shannon, and people nowadays know John Shannon because he transitioned from a behind-the-scenes role to an in-front-of-the-role position, at least for a little while there. Why was he so important to the development of the hot stove, and what impact, what is it that he did almost on a show-in and show-out basis that made him so influential?
He's just the best in the world at what he was doing at the time, and other people recognized that he was the one that the Olympic people would call every 4 years to put together the world feed for Olympic hockey, because they knew what he could do. He had a great sense of vision. He's the one who, when he became the head of Hockey Night, went from one game at 8 o'clock to two games starting at 7. The doubleheaders were his idea. The hot stove was his idea, because it wasn't just the one solitary idea that popped into his head. He had the sense of vision of the whole concept. And he said, if we're going to have this much hockey, if we're going to have 6 hours of hockey, which, by the way, ended up bringing in more than 50% of the CBC's revenue in those 6 hours, the revenue for the week, most of it was right there. And then we're going to have a full program. We're going to have a complete slate. So we start with period one. Then we've got Don Cherry. He draws people. Then we've got two. Now, sometimes in the second period, people might start to drift away. We need something to hold them there. So that's where he built the hot stove, and that brought people into three, and then you go right from three to the next game with very, very little weight in the middle if you can, or maybe just bring in Don Cherry for a couple of minutes to keep people posted. Then you go to that one, and so now you're up to at least four periods of hockey, and by that time, people now figure, well, they've been watching it all night. They're not going to go out at that time of night or whatever, and so you get the strong viewership throughout. And he brought in the idea of those four people in different cities, which was unique at the time. People don't realize, perhaps, when you see it now on ESPN and that it's pretty common. This was the first time this happened, and it was a tremendous technological decision, because bringing those people together at the same time from all these different cities had never been done before, and it wasn't that easy. And he brought in the people who could do it, the people behind the scenes who got that arranged, and gave the viewers something completely unique. Something that had been unknown. You're going to watch four people argue about hockey between periods and tell you all these silly little stories, some of which are important, some of which are just fun, like, the love triangle between Anna Kournikova and Sergei Fedorov and Pavel Bure, and bring in all these kind of things, and some of the strange nicknames that people are being called, like somebody being, when the Geico people were doing those ads, that even a caveman could do it. There were a couple of guys around the league who looked sort of like Brendan Burns and that, who got called Geico by their teammates, and, bring in all these things. So you'd have a bit of a laugh. You'd find out some insights into the game. And John had taken over after a time when John Ziegler had been under tremendous pressure throughout the playoffs, and there were developments every day with a battle going on as to whether he was going to stay or not, and what some owners were thinking and what was going on, and this was the guy running the game and everything. Not a word of it on Hockey Night in Canada. And he saw these other things in the newspapers, in the Globe and Mail, which had a good sports section there, probably the best in Canada at the time, which it doesn't have anymore, and the Boston Globe and places like that. And he said, we need to give the people all these things and have these little stories and these anecdotes and these little bits of information, and how do we do this? And so, I have tremendous respect for John. He is the one who put it all together, and he does have a great legacy. And unfortunately, with Canada being Canada and operating the way it is, then they brought in a woman who had no TV experience, whatever, to run things in the CBC, and John said, this is the way we're going to do it, but she didn't want to do it that way, so John moved on elsewhere and didn't like the way that he was being handled as the producer, because he wanted to do it his way, and so he should. He was the best at it, but that doesn't always happen, so he went to the other side of the camera, and I think it's a real loss, really, for the TV industry to have John on that side of the camera. But when I say that, I'm not implying that he doesn't do a very good job on the other side. He does. He digs up stories, and some of the ones, it was not uncommon for him to give us a good story just before we got the cameras rolling for Hot Stove either.
The book is called Hockey's Hot Stove, The Untold Stories of the Original Insiders, Al Strachan. Appreciate your time, Al. I hope you're doing well. Stay safe, and we'll do it again real soon. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. I had to play golf early for you guys today. Hope you appreciate that.
I guess, and Al, I guess next time we have you on, we'll talk about Eric D's bachelor party, because I know that we want to hear a little bit more about that.
That was an epic.
That story was... That was, you know, that was my favorite chapter in the book, John. Al, sorry, that was my favorite chapter. I couldn't believe what I was reading, but it is worth picking up. It's available at booksellers everywhere. Hockey's Hot Stove: The Untold Stories of the Original Insiders. Al Strachan, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Take care, Al. When we come back, much more on the Winnipeg Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
On for Gustafson. Gustafson protects the puck against Carlson. Gustafson in with a wrister. Scores!
From last November in San Jose, David Gustafson getting his first NHL goal. Someday it'll be a top corner snipe when he's telling it to his grandchildren, as opposed to a bit of a miscue by, who was it, Alex Stalock, if I'm not mistaken, at that point in time. But it doesn't matter. It's a goal nonetheless.
Welcome. Well, the best, sorry, Drew, I was just going to say, the best is Dave M. tweeted this out, I think it was a week ago, Dave. Mm-hmm. He scored a goal that was almost
identical.
It was a carbon copy.
Yeah.
And I think you actually, didn't you have them side by side?
After the other, but it was unbelievable, because I thought about it and I said, that's almost the identical goal he scored in his first NHL game, or first NHL goal, sorry.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live here on TSN Radio 1290. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich, located in the Cordon Village Mall. Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for over 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Of course, it being code red, give Bernstein's a call. They'll put together your order. They'll bring it right out to your car, curbside pickup, whatever accommodations you need. Bernstein's Deli is willing to go the extra mile to help you out. Check them out online at bernsteinsdeli.com.
The Illegal Curve Sandwich tastes even better these days, you know, because of, you know, everything that's going on in the world, you know.
You're eating your emotions, basically?
COVID. Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, I don't even really have any emotions anymore because I'm just eating all the time. So,
but as long as you're eating the Illegal Curve Sandwich from Bernstein's, that's the important part. Dave, you had a conversation with David Gustafson. You've been putting it up on our website, illegalcurve.com.
Yep.
You know, sort of, you know, what did you learn in talking to David Gustafson earlier this week? And you know, how do you get the mindset that where he is in terms of getting ready for the upcoming season?
So, I had a chance to talk to him, spoke to him for about 25 minutes on Thursday, and, you know, it's just, you get so much more insight from a player when you're having an opportunity to speak to them one-on-one. The cameras aren't there. They're a lot more relaxed. And I thought, he's a well-spoken kid. I mean, I've spoken to him, obviously, when he was sent down to the... I've spoke to him when he was with the Jets, but I also spoke to him on a more personal nature when he was with the Moose. And you get the sense of his maturity. He's a physically mature person at 20 years old. I mean, he looks... At, like, 18, 19, he looked like a man already. And a lot of players don't have that sort of already... you know, that's what we always talk about, having to get bigger, faster, stronger. Well, he was already the bigger. And he was stronger. So, I mean, he already had that kind of setup, which is good because of the kind of game he plays. He's he's that quintessential 200-foot player, right, that every kind of coach really wants. And he's a guy who wants that responsibility. And that's the one thing that really, you know, I talked about it with Pascal Vincent, his head coach with the Manitoba Moose at the end of the Moose season. And one thing David spoke about was just that idea of wanting to be on the ice, wanting to, in those critical situations, not just to score the game-winning goal in overtime, but also to be there if you're killing a penalty and you need to win a face-off. Like, he is that guy who's dedicated to his hockey career. And it really is, it gets conveyed by, you know, like I said, the dedication to playing in all aspects of the game. So he spoke about being sent down to the Moose after the World Junior Tournament when Sweden won the bronze. And he said, and you know, he wasn't playing right away, but he said, I wasn't sour about it. I looked at it as an opportunity. And I thought, okay, well, that's a good attitude to have, because a lot of guys don't necessarily take it like that. They'll eventually come to that, but you don't necessarily have that right away. He has that maturity about him. And so, he talked about, you know, he said, you know, originally, you know, getting kind of focused on the game in the AHL was a little different for him, but eventually started to figure it out. And as I've written before, he, Christian Vesalainen and Christian Reichel had a very nice trio on that top Moose line. But I thought really from what I learned really was that in Tingsryd, who he's playing with in the Swedish league, it's an opportunity for him to go back home. That's his hometown. So he's, you know, he's with his family. And he talked about, you know, one of the pieces I wrote yesterday was just about his number choice, why he wears number 19. And that's because of his dad. And he just, you can see he's a guy who's connected to his family and how important it is. And he spoke about it. He said a lot of times when players, you know, European players get an opportunity, they go back home to play hockey. Not many get the opportunity to do what he's doing, which is play early in his career. But what he said and what I spoke about, because he's, what it's one thing he's been able to do is really, explore that offensive, you know, aspect of his game. Because really, when we talk about David Gustafson, we talk about a defensive player,
sure,
a defensively smart player. But we don't generally talk about his offense. And he's got a pretty good shot, pretty deceptively good shot, I would say. And I asked him about that. I said, is this something that you're kind of exploring now? He said, that's one of the good opportunities. So to your point, Drew, one of the benefits for a guy like David Gustafson is that he will come into a Jets training camp playing games. Now, he's injured right now. He has a lower body injury. He was held out of the game on Wednesday. He's not playing tonight in for Tingsryd. So they play again on Monday. We'll see if he plays. He told me it wasn't a significant injury. But the point I'm making is that whenever this training camp comes about, you're going to have a guy who's, I think, going to be able to challenge for a spot in the NHL.
More on Dave's conversation is available at illegalcurve.com. You'll have more coming up all week, is that right?
All weekend, yeah.
All weekend long, so check out the website, illegalcurve.com, for more of Dave's conversation with David Gustafson. When we come back, we head down to Omaha, Nebraska, where we're going to be joined by Brad Schlossman of the Grand Forks Herald to talk about the start of the season for the North Dakota Fighting Hawks. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturdays are for the Curve on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mindell, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuk with you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can reach us here via text message. Send your text to 129090. And, of course, our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is available at illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From the Grand Forks Herald, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Brad Schlossman. He joins us from beautiful Omaha, Nebraska, where the WCHC Hockey Pod is continuing on covering, he's there covering the North Dakota Fighting Hawks. Brad, good morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, guys. Always good to chat with you.
Likewise, Brad, obviously brought you on to talk about the Fighting Hawks, and they're off to a 2-0 start so far, number one team in the nation. But before we get to their on-ice performance, I guess we have to get to the national anthem performance, a very powerful move, a powerful moment before the Fighting Hawks' first game against Miami of Ohio earlier this week. You wrote about this, you broke the story. Jasper Weatherby and Jacob Bernard Docker both take a knee during the national anthem. Why did they do it, and why was it such an the importance of the moment in relation to the atmosphere in Grand Forks?
Well, I would say for starters, both guys are they both have done a lot of studying on racism in America and across the world, and how everything. How historic racism has affected things to today. And Jasper Weatherby's family has a unique place in that. His grandparents were civil rights lawyers. His grandfather worked on a case with Martin Luther King Jr., worked for Thurgood Marshall at the Legal Defense Fund. His grandmother marched in Selma. They were both at the March on Washington. His mother had been an activist against apartheid in South Africa. So he comes from a very long background of people who fought against racism. And now it's Jasper's turn. He's kind of joined in his family legacy. And I think one of their reasons And Jasper and Jacob live together. They're roommates, they're classmates. Off the ice, they're very involved in initiatives to improve things. They're both members of the student athlete diversity group at North Dakota. You know, they've hosted team movie nights where they watch movies on how racism has affected people and groups of people in the United States. And so they've been very involved, and I think it was a way to try to spark conversation. And I think they knew they were going to have some people who were upset about it, and they also have had a lot of people who have supported them too. But I think just in general, it was a statement to try to raise awareness, try to spark conversations, try to see if people will be willing to continue their learning processes and join them in their battle against racism.
And Brad, we should mention Jasper Weatherby scored a goal yesterday for UND, put them up at the time in the game. He's obviously one of UND's top players. And, you know, Jordan Kawaguchi, who's a Hobie Baker finalist, he scored that big overtime goal. And, you know, I just have to say, you know, it's just amazing that we're actually talking about real hockey on the ice, because we haven't had a lot to talk about here in Winnipeg and Manitoba, with us being, you know, under a code red, unfortunately. But, you know, UND is 2-0 to start the pod. And we want to get into the pod with you, you know, because you're, of course, there, and we want to get into that with you a little bit. But, you know, Jake Sanderson, you know, we had Coach Bradbury on the show last week, and obviously, you know, Jake Sanderson's a guy that's expected to play a key role for U.S. at the World Juniors in Alberta. But, you know, that goal, I saw the highlight, and it was an absolute bomb on the power play. Not only did Sanderson score a goal, but he got an assist. So, in I know you've watched Jake Sanderson practice, but just, you know, in over the course of a couple of games, what are your first impressions for a guy who, you know, it looks like he's going to have a really good long NHL career?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I thought the two games that North Dakota's played, we saw both ways he impacts games. I thought in the first game against Miami, he showed how he can be such an elite shutdown defender. You know, he makes complex plays look really easy. He can get in awkward positions and smoothly get out of them. He makes really smart plays. He gets to the puck to open guys, gets breakouts. His gap control is really good, doesn't give guys time and space. And I just thought in that first game, a lot of that played out to a T. You just saw the way he can shut down teams defensively. And then last night we saw the offense. You know, that, like you said, that goal on the one-timer was just a rocket, an elite shot. And then the plays he made to get the assist was just a heck of a play. You know, his line mates were going for a change, and he was kind of left alone there. And he carried the puck low to the corner in the offensive zone. He held it and fought off a guy long enough to where his teammates started coming in the zone, and then he threw a pass all the way across the ice to Ethan Frisch, who scored the goal. And it was just a play that you have to be really elite to make that type of play. And, you know, he made two really elite offensive plays last night, and, you know, they don't win that game without Jake Sanderson. So he can impact games on both ends.
Brad Schlossman is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. A reminder that Toy Mountain is going on all day today. For more information, go to toymountain.ca or text TOY to 129090, and we'll send you all the details.
You know, Brad, whenever I'm getting ready to have prepared for the segment with you, I look at the Grand Forks Herald. I check out what you've been writing, and I got to tell you, when I read your one of your most recent articles, I thought, well, that can't be right. 18-0 on a faceoff. I mean, Shane Pinto put on a performance that is beyond legendary, and I like the fact that you weren't even sure if it was true, so you went and at 2 a.m. you went and reviewed that. But what were you thinking when you saw that number, and when you watched that game, were you just that must be blown you away, because I read about it and it's fascinating.
Yeah, you guys know how it is, like, between periods you get the stat sheets, right? And you kind of scroll through it, and then, like, a number like that jumps out at you. Well, with some COVID protocols, we're not getting stat sheets all the time between periods. So we weren't getting these numbers, and then they email them to us after the game instead of physical ones. So, you know, it was a night game, so I quickly filed my game story. I walked back to the hotel, opened up my computer, and started going through the stats because I always do another a follow-up on things I noticed in the stats. And then I saw that, and I was like, 18-0, I've never heard of that. 18-0 in faceoffs. But, you know, sometimes there are mistakes in college hockey stats, and I said, that can't be right. There's no way. Like, there's a glitch. Something was wrong. And so I pulled up the game, and I brewed a pot of coffee and watched it from about 2 to 3, 3:30 in the morning and tracked every faceoff he took, and it was spot on. He went 18-0 in faceoffs. Just a way Shane Pinto can really impact the game that I don't think people really talk about. He's a 200-foot player. He's an outstanding offensive player, great in puck possession. He's a good defensive player. And then look at that, 18-0 in the faceoff circle. He's kind of doing it all for North Dakota this year.
Certainly an incredible performance. Brad Schlossman, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, talking about the North Dakota Fighting Hawks off to a 2-0 start of the season in the bubble in Omaha, the number one team in the nation. Brad, who are the Fighting Hawks' main competition this year? You know, if they're not to win, who's going to be the team that wins at the end of the NCAA season?
Well, I think for starters in their league, Denver is the other team to look at. And that's another reason why last night's win was a big one, because that's the team that I think most people think UND will be battling for the league championship. So, you know, I think Denver's going to be in the mix till the end. They have a lot of really, really good players. You saw them make some really skilled plays. Carter Savoy had 2 goals last night. Bobby Brink had a couple of really nice assists. He'll be going to the World Junior team here tomorrow he'll be heading out to the World Junior team. So, you know, he's a good player, and their team is good. I think in the Big Ten, Minnesota's off to a great start. They're 6-0. They definitely look like the class in the Big Ten right now. And, you know, Boston College has had a really impressive start out east. They're 3-0. They've played really good opponents. They've played Providence and UMass, and they've done it without Alex Newhook. So I think BC is going to be a factor. So those are a few of the teams I think to keep an eye on.
Brad, just final question here. You know, we mentioned earlier, you know, you've been there in Omaha covering UND for a few days now, and we wanted to ask you what the atmosphere is like, because we know that, you know, the NHL pod or bubble in Edmonton was a huge success with no players, no staff testing positive for COVID-19, and obviously we hope that there are none or very few players who test positive in the NCHC pod. But what's it like there? What's the atmosphere there? I know that, you know, they play at Baxter Arena, which I believe is a relatively new arena. But, you know, what's it been like for you to, you know, cover it so far? It's obviously, you know, a very unique situation.
Yeah, so far, health-wise, it's been great. I'm unaware of any positive tests from any teams. So credit goes to a lot of the players. Obviously, they're making some sacrifices to make sure they stay healthy and make sure people around them stay healthy. So that's a big positive. The games at Baxter Arena, like you said, 5 years old, a very new building. Watching games without fans, you know, like I remember this spring when they were about to go into the playoffs, and before they shut it down, they announced that they were going to do the first round of the playoffs without fans. And my first thought was like, this is going to be surreal. This is going to be so crazy. Like going into a game, you know, imagine going into a Jets game with no fans. Like you're thinking, you know, this is just going to be the weirdest thing. But I think I've watched enough sporting events over the last several months, including the NHL, that it's really not weird to me anymore. Like I thought it was going to be really weird, and it's just not weird. So, you know, I think part of that is because I've watched so many sporting events. I think the other part is that the benches are bringing lots of energy. These games are not lacking energy or emotion. Last night, the teams left the ice. They were screaming at each other from across the arena. A lot of times that emotion is provoked, I think, by the crowd and crazy atmospheres. Well, no, these are intense games. So I think it's a little more exciting after a goal when you get the sold out crowd going nuts and the atmosphere. But honestly, I think the game's been great. I think there's been energy. I don't think it's been super weird. And I think it's been fun. And like you said, you guys up there have been without hockey for a long time. People here have too. And I think everyone's grateful to be able to sit back and watch some games.
No question. Brad Schlossman covers the North Dakota Fighting Hawks for the Grand Forks Herald. He joins us from Omaha, Nebraska, where the Fighting Hawks are playing in the NCHC bubble. Brad, appreciate your time and insight. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one.
Likewise, Brad. Take care. When we come back, one final segment. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live here on TSN Radio 1290. As quickly as we're in, we're back out again. Thanks for joining us, everybody. This has been an entertaining couple of hours. A big thank you to our sponsors: Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, and Zappia Group Realty. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. In case you missed any of the show, it'll be available for download on our website, illegalcurve.com. It'll be on tsn1290.ca. It's wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, subscribe to us. Let us know what you think of the program. Big props back at the station to Sean Asor, doing a great job making us sound so good week in and week out. For Ezra Ginsberg, for Dave Manuk, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Stay safe. Support Toy Mountain. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.